the introduction. I mean, again, I thank the speakers. It's wonderful being here at Field, and I've enjoyed being here already for a week, so I know what I'm talking about. So thank you again. All right, so I'm going to talk about a specific or particular kind of kinetic equation or kinetic model that was proposed about a century ago by Lorentz, by the Dutch physicist Lorentz. And what he had in mind was proposing, was applying to the motion of electrons in metals. He had in mind of applying the methods of kinetic theory, which at the time, in 1905, were relatively recent. So the equation that he came up with is written here. So it's an equation for the phase space density of electrons, F is a function of T, X, and Z, which is the density of electrons which at time T are located at position X and have velocity V. And these electrons, they're advected under the effect of the electric force, capital F of T and X, which for that matter is known, so there is no, if you want, the electric force is not the self-consistent electric field defined by F, but it's an external force, so capital F is given. And on the right-hand side of this kinetic equation, you'll find a collision integral, C of F, or Tx. This collision integral acts on the velocity V only in the number density F, as is usual in most kinetic models. And what this Lorentz collision integral models is simply the fact that whenever an electron meets impinges on an atom of the metal, it's reflected following the laws of specular reflection, specularly reflected. So it's a very, very crude and classical model. In particular, well, in 1905, it had nothing quantum in it. It's a very classical model. And there are two things to observe, namely, and that's explicitly said by Lorentz in his paper, that you observe here that the equation is linear, at variance with the Boltzmann equation, which is nonlinear. And the reason for that is that electron-electron collisions are neglected, because you're looking at a scale where the size of the electron is so small that you neglect those collisions. The only thing that you care about are the collisions of the electrons with the background, which is some lattice, if you want, of metallic atoms. The characteristics of the background medium, namely the, I mean, they appear here. So here you have the number of metallic atoms per unit volume. Here you have the radius of each such atom. M is the mass of the electron. And so V is the velocity. And pops out here. Notice that because of the collision mechanism, which is just specular reflection, the collision on one atom will not change the velocity of the particle, I mean the speed of the particle, so that you can think of this equation as written on the energy surface of one particle, meaning that the modulus or the length of the variable V can be fixed in this model. So again, so this is a kinetic equation, therefore it's a mesoscopic model, meaning that it's a model that's between microscopic and macroscopic. That's it's a single particle phase space equation. Okay, so it's more detailed than if you had simply a drift diffusion equation, which would be a macroscopic equation. But of course, it's not directly a microscopic model because you're dealing with the single particle phase space and not with the n particle phase space. Okay, and it's a statistical description and not a first principle. The fact that it's a statistical description appears when you look at the collision integral here, where you clearly see that here you have the effect of collision with some kind of random unit vector, which you may think about, which you may think of as the external unit normal to the typical atom that you encounter in the background medium. There's a probabilistic interpretation to this linear kinetic equation, which is that the direction of each particle jumps at exponentially distributed times, so that jump times and jumps and directions are independent, and this prescription here justifies the appearance of the Lorentz collision integral C. That's exactly what it means. And between two jumps, each particle is driven by the electric force field, and this justifies the appearance of the streaming operator in the left-hand side of the equation. Now, let's think about the microscopic model first. So the thing that Lorentz had in mind was a gas of electrons which would collide on a given configuration of spherical obstacles. Okay, so here I've considered a periodic configuration of spherical obstacles, and I've taken the simplest of all lattices, namely the cubical lattice. So to define the notation, I'll introduce Zr to be the set of x's in Rd whose distance to integer points, to lattice points, is more than r, with r obviously less than 1/2. So here you see six such obstacles, and the typical particle path of an electron bouncing off these obstacles. And here there's a zoom of the of one period, if you want, which is the fundamental domain of this periodic structure, where you see a square of size 1 or a cube of size 1 with an obstacle diameter 2r inside. And so you want to, you can think of this periodic, of this period or this fundamental domain as the quotient space of Vr by the translations, by the, sure? I'm considering a square lattice in what I'm doing here. Sure. Okay. My answer to this will appear later. We're going to consider a scale where whatever the lattice, whatever the geometry of the lattice, there will always be the billiard system that we're going to consider is not going to be a finite horizon. There will be always free trajectories. Okay? Okay? So for that matter, whether you take the cubic lattice or not, it's immaterial. Okay? So as I said before, particles move freely between the obstacles. So if x of t belongs to the open set z, which is the set free for the set of free motion, then the equation is very simple. X dot equals v, v dot equals 0. Here, notice I'm neglecting the force field, the electric force. All I'm interested in right now is justifying the collision integral. So I don't care about, at the moment, I don't care about the electric force. Okay? So the free motion between the particles, between the obstacles, and whenever a particle impinges on the surface of one obstacle, it's specularly reflected, like so. So R sub n is the specular reflection. So I remind you of the formula for R sub n. So R is the specular reflection here. R sub omega of v is v minus 2 v dot omega omega. Okay. So the specular reflection with respect to the outward unit normal to the obstacle, right? So it's you have the picture here for one obstacle. Good. So by this prescription, you define a flow, which is a broken flow in the sense that it's not continuous in velocity, but nevertheless it's a flow. Meaning that to each starting point and initial velocity, you define an x sub t of xv, v sub t of xv, and I've recalled the r here just to remind you that the geometry is such that the radius of each obstacle is r. Okay? Now, with this prescription, you can start from an initial density of electrons, and you propagate it by the flow, by this broken flow. And now, here, I'm going to introduce a particular scaling, which in dimension D, as written here, is exactly the analog for this linear equation of the Boltzmann grad scaling that leads from the dynamics of n particle, the n-body classical dynamics, to the Boltzmann equation. So the analog here is that you want, okay, so here you want that the radius of each obstacle be like epsilon to the 1 over d minus 1, where d is the dimension, and you shrink the period, which before was 1, you shrink it to be epsilon. So the period now is epsilon, and inside each square of size epsilon, you have an obstacle which has size epsilon to the d over d minus 1, okay? All right, so now with this f epsilon so defined, as epsilon tends to 0, you would like to know whether f epsilon converges in some weak topology to f, f being the solution of the Lorentz kinetic equation for conveniently chosen initial data. Now, this result has been proved for a Poisson distribution of obstacles. It's been proved by Galavotti in an unpublished paper in 1972, a paper which, by the way, is reproduced in his book, in his treatise on statistical mechanics. It's a very nice paper which contains the idea which was later used by Lanford in its derivation of the Boltzmann equation from particles, in that instead of working on the equation, you're working directly on the solution. So it's a bit weird. In order to justify, and it's the same with the Galavotti paper, in order to justify the Lorentz kinetic equation, what you prove is that this f epsilon, which is the solution of the Liouville equation generated by the dynamical system, you write it as a series expansion, and you pass through the limit in each term of the series, and you prove that what you end up with is a series, and you recognize in this series the solution to the kinetic equation. So it's a bit weird, because you find information about the solution before actually finding the equation, which, you know, I mean, we would prefer it, of course, to be the other way around. But it seems that you know more about the solution than about the equation. It's weird. But that's the way it is. And it's a feature that is common to this derivation and to that of Lanford. Well, later, the Galavotti's result was amplified by Spohn, in that Spohn considered, if I'm not mistaken, distributions of obstacles that were slightly more general than Poisson. And there's another paper by Boldrighini, Bunimovic, and Sinai where they prove pointwise convergence, pointwise in the sense that they prove convergence for a typical configuration of obstacles. Okay? So that's what happened for random distributions of obstacles. But as we shall see, things are somewhat different for periodic distributions. Okay, before going further, let me define the notion of free path length and the distribution thereof. So free path length in the probabilistic jargon would be simply what you would call an exit time. So it's the time that you exit the domain where the particles are supposed to move freely. So in other words, if you take a point x and the velocity v, and now, as I said before, you can always set the length of the velocity to be 1. So if you start from the point x in the direction v, tau sub r of x and v is simply the first time where you're going to hit an obstacle. So it's defined as the infimum of all the positive t's such that x plus tv belongs to the boundary of vr. Okay? And now what you're interested in is not so much this tau sub r of x and v, which is a widely oscillating function, but you're interested in the distribution thereof for x and z uniformly distributed on the domain left free, the domain for free motion, and the direction. So you start from uniformly distributed initial point, uniformly distributed direction, and you want to know, you're interested in the probability that tau sub r of x and z be larger than some t given beforehand. Okay? All right, so there's a first theorem about this phi sub r of t is that there exist two positive constants, c minus and c plus, such that for all t sufficiently large, then phi sub r of t lies between constants over t r to the d minus 1 and another constant over t r to the d minus 1. Of course, because this is a probability, this number here has better be less than 1, and that's why this bound here is valid only for large t's. Okay? All right, so let me mention that this upper bound plus the lower bound for d equal 2 in the Plane case were proved in the paper with Borga and Venberg in 1998, and later the lower bound for d larger than 3 by a similar method was improved with Venberg. All right, so now this in itself has an interesting consequence, namely that if you average the exit time, so the mean of tau sub r over uniformly distributed x and v's, turns out to be simply the integral of phi sub r of t, okay, and this is a logarithmic divergence for large t's, namely you have an infinite mean free path, okay. So you might think it's not so much of a surprise because, as was mentioned by Walter before, in a square lattice, you're going to have three trajectories corresponding, for instance, directions which are parallel to the axis. You can also choose rational directions. Now, you have to be careful about which rational directions you choose because that will depend on the size of the obstacles. But how many rational directions you choose depends on the size of the obstacle, but precisely you let the size of the obstacle go to zero. So in the limit, it's not surprising, although it's a very, it's a logarithmic divergence, right? So it's not completely clear that this thing should diverge in the first place. Let me also mention that the fact that you find an infinite mean free path depends very much upon which measure you average with. There's an equally natural measure to compute the mean free path, which consists in instead of distributing the x's uniformly in the domain of free motion in the domain vr, you can distribute it uniformly at the surface of one obstacle. Okay, and if you do so, then the average of tau sub r is finite and can be computed explicitly, and that's a computation that goes back to Luis Santalo. Okay, so the fact that you find plus infinity here is not so easily predictable. I don't say anything about the short t limit. Sorry. Yes, I don't know anything about the short time limit for this phi sub r of t. So phi sub r is the probability that tau sub r is larger than t. Okay. And so that's the definition. And as for your question, namely what's the short time behavior of phi sub r of t, my answer is that I don't know really how it behaves. Sorry? Yes. All I'm saying is that phi sub r of 0 is equal to 1. Okay? That's clear. Now, what I'm interested in is the integral, how it behaves near tau equals 0. All right, I know it converges to 1. That's trivial. But then how it does converge to 1, I have no idea. Okay? All right, so here are some numerical computations. This is a log-log plot of phi sub r of t versus t for various values of the radius r. And you can see that for large T, this thing behaves like minus T, and therefore it supports the idea that for large T, these two bounds should actually shrink, and you anticipate that for large T, phi sub r of T should behave like a constant over T for some constant to be found, and if you plot TR phi sub r of T, then indeed it supports this guess, although you're multiplying something that tends to zero by something that's going very large, so their numerical roundoffs are pretty terrible here, but it nevertheless supports the idea that you should find a constant as something like constant over T as T tends to infinity. And indeed, in two-space dimension, which nevertheless were the case where these numerical simulations were done, there is a result that confirms this behavior. It's a result which I obtained with Emmanuel Cagliotti, and which says the following. So for D equal 2, so you consider the quantity phi sub r of T over r, because clearly T over r is the right thing to look at, right? So you want T, so D equals 2 here, so the phi sub r of T should behave like 1 over T r, so if you want to say anything, you should look at phi sub r of T over r. And this thing, as r tends to infinity, converges to a constant, behaves like 2 over pi squared T, plus an error which is of the size 1 over T squared. However, the convergence here is not what we've been able to prove, it's not pointwise convergence, but a kind of convergence of a Cesaro mean. And the Cesaro mean is computed with respect to the scale invariant measure of R plus. Okay? So this, if you want, is an amplification of this result here, which tells you that these bounds are sharp with the C plus and C minus that in the end coalesce to be 2 over pi squared. Well, I mean, maybe I have time to go back to this at the end. So let me move on. It's a bit more complicated than this, maybe. Okay. So now let me go back to the initial problem that we looked at, namely what happens in terms of the Lorentz kinetic equation. So with these results. These results suggest that the exit time, the tau sub r, is not going to be exponentially distributed at all, but that the tails of the distribution of exit time are going to be much longer. So typically, it's 1 over t. So that suggests that for periodic distributions of obstacle, you should not get a Lorentz kinetic equation as mentioned initially, simply because this Lorentz kinetic equation here, if you remember what I said at the beginning of the talk, implies that the collision times, I mean, when you write this equation, essentially you have, it's an equation for particles that have jump times and velocity that are exponentially distributed. And this is simply excluded by the previous estimates which I had on the distribution of exit times. So what happens is that if you set the scale properly, as recalled here, then there exists, you can find all kinds of initial densities that are isotropic in velocity, and for which the Fn, that is the number density propagated by the dynamical systems, will not converge, nor any subsequence thereof converges in L infinity weak star to the solution of the Lorentz kinetic model with that initial density as initial data for the Lorentz kinetic equation. For that matter, not only you do not obtain this Lorentz kinetic equation in the limit, but you will not obtain any other kinetic equation where the Lorentz collision integral would be replaced by the usual scattering collision operator that would involve a probability of transitions from V to V prime. I mean, the usual collision operator in linear transport theory. However, by the maximum principle on the free transport equation or in the Liouville equation, the Fn we know is a sequence that's bounded in L infinity in Tx and V. And so the natural question is there an equation that governs its weak star limit points as n converges to infinity, since we know that this thing is relatively weak star compact in L infinity, so it's a natural question to know what these limit points actually do. Now, we have no idea what goes on. However, if you look at the simplified model where instead of being reflected by the obstacles, the particles disappear whenever they touch an obstacle, and simply think of this domain as some kind of sieve, and so the particles fall in holes, right? So they disappear from the domain. So that's a much simpler problem to treat. And so here, what you're looking at is the number density of such particles that fall into the hole. And so it simply means that you're looking at the free transport equation with absorbing boundary condition at the surface of the obstacle. And so I remind you the fundamental domain of which is period R and obstacle of size R squared in dimension 2, and the result, which is a direct implication of the result with Cagliotti, tells you that the G sub R of Tx and V should converge to something. G of T for small r and large t, and the G of Tx and V that behaves like 2 over pi squared t times G initial of x minus tv and v. So if you want, this is the solution of free transport, and you have this prefactor 2 over pi squared t, which takes care of the damping due to the fact that particles disappear from the set Vr. And this, of course, suggests that if there is any limiting equation for the above model, well, if you think of dt plus v del x plus a damping term, the damping term should be 1 over t times g. And, of course, this might look a bit desperate for as a Cauchy problem, but remember, this thing, you hope, is going to be valid only for large t's, because this asymptotic of the... there's a asymptotic equivalent for the distribution of exit times only true for large t's. So, you know, this is pretty much it for the absorbing problem. So we know there is some weird effect that takes place for large t's. As for what happens for the reflecting case, which is the really physically interesting one, for the Billiard case, of that I have no idea. That being said, thank you for your attention.